Welcome to the Science Podcast for October 28th, 2011. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. This week, the impact of mitochondrial priming on chemotherapy outcomes, studying the python heart to improve human cardiac health, and the prospects for energy from inertial confinement fusion, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Cytotoxic chemotherapy has been the mainstay of cancer treatment for the past 60 years, but scientists still don't have a complete understanding of why it is effective in some tissues and not in others. A team led by Anthony Letai of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute hypothesized that differences in drug response may be due to differences in the readiness of tumor cells to undergo cell death, a measurable property they call mitochondrial priming. The results may have implications for developing cancer treatments and for predicting therapeutic responses of tumors to chemotherapy. Letai spoke with me about the findings from his office in Boston.
Most simply, this is a study of why does chemotherapy work? It's puzzled me for some time why it is that chemotherapy works at all. Why should it be killing cancer cells and not normal cells? And then why does it kill some cancer cells better than others? There is a textbook answer for this, which is that it all relates to differential proliferation rates between these cells. But I think the bottom line is that this has not been studied as closely as many would presume, and there are plenty of counterexamples to this fast proliferation increased chemosensitivity argument. There is clinical examples like indolent cells, like CLL is a great example, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, that nonetheless is quite chemosensitive, and yet it has cells that divide, you know, sometimes on the order of once a year. So it seemed that there had to be something more to it than just rapid cell division.
And the approach that you've taken here kind of centers on a different variable, the mitochondria, the respiratory power plants of the cell, as kind of a key to all of this. Why focus on the mitochondria?
Well, in addition to its famous role as being the power plant for the cell, the mitochondrion is also the place where an awful lot of pro-death and anti-death signals get integrated, so that the cell makes a decision whether or not to engage in this pathway called apoptosis. Apoptosis is essentially a cell suicide program that every cell in your body has, but it needs to integrate a whole lot of different and complicated signals, and the mitochondrion is where that takes place.
And you're hypothesizing in particular that the efficacy of chemotherapy varies with something that you call mitochondrial priming. What exactly is mitochondrial priming?
Well, the key point of no return event in apoptosis, the mitochondrial pathway of apoptosis, is permeabilization of the mitochondrial outer membrane. And that you can view that as sort of being like a cliff. It's really a point of no return. Before it permeabilizes, the cell and the mitochondria are just fine. After it permeabilizes, it's a very rapid commitment to utter destruction of the cell.
So in a way, it's the mitochondria themselves committing suicide.
It is. The mitochondria start the process off, and they force the whole cell to follow along.
And so this mitochondrial priming is, in some sense, you know, how close a mitochondrion is to that point, measured in some way? Or?
Exactly. We asked, just really, in simple terms, a very basic question, which is, could it be that some cells simply start closer to this cliff's edge than others? And might it be that it's those cells that are more sensitive to chemotherapy, which generally kills via this apoptotic pathway?
And so you had this idea that there might be a link between priming and tumor sensitivity to chemotherapy. How did you go about establishing that link in the laboratory?
That is the key. How do you actually measure this concept of closeness to this cliff that I've just metaphorically made up? Well, that's where BH3 profiling came in. Rather than a genetic test or some other kind of protein measuring test, we turned to a purely functional test. It turns out that the pro-death signals that are directed towards the mitochondria following a lot of insults, including chemotherapy, all of those insults contain these domains called BH3 domains that are necessary for the pro-death function of these proteins. And what we did is we simply abstracted these, just took these and synthesized these domains, which contain about 20 amino acids. And that meant we could apply very careful fixed and measured doses to mitochondria and simply measure how sensitive mitochondria are to these different BH3 peptides. And quite simply, mitochondria that are very sensitive to these peptides were ones that we classified as being close to the clift or very primed, and those that were insensitive we described as unprimed.
And that's because BH3 is associated with the cell death?
That's right. So when a cell death signal is sent, it involves these members of the BCL2 family of proteins, which controls apoptosis, but it involves these pro-death members of the BCL2 family of proteins that contain pro-death BH3 domains. And those BH3 domains are the business end of those proteins. Without them, they can't execute their death function. So it turns out that you can just take these BH3 peptides alone that are just 20 amino acids. In the biology context, they're in these large proteins, but just these 20 amino acids alone, taken out of context, by themselves have pro-death function. So that's small enough that you can just synthesize them. So that's what we did, and those were the reagents we used to test mitochondria.
And so what did those tests tell you?
Well, first we performed them on just cell lines, and they told us that in cell lines we saw a good correlation between how primed a cell was and how sensitive it was to chemotherapy at the cellular level. And once we saw we could do that, we're at a cancer center, so we said, well, let's try it on actual clinical cancer samples and ask the question, which was a big jump, can knowing something about this little tiny mitochondria inside a tumor cell tell us about how the actual tumor responds in the clinic? So essentially we took pre-treatment biopsies from patients with four different cancers, and we tested them with BH3 profiling and were able to rank them according to how primed they were, how close they are to this cliff's edge. And then we correlated that with clinical response, you know, how soon the tumor shrank, how long they stayed away, how many people had complete responses and so forth. And across all four diseases we tested, we found a good correlation.
Okay, you found this correlation. How can you tell that this priming isn't, I guess, just an effect of the chemotherapy? You know, is there a step from correlation to determination here?
Or? Yeah, I'd say there's two ways to look at that. One is that we're measuring the cells before they ever see chemotherapy. These are pre-treatment samples so that there's no possibility of the chemotherapy actually causing the priming immediately. Okay, so we're measuring before they see the chemotherapy. But I think you bring up a good question. Is this purely a correlation? I don't think it is, because in a variety of different ways, we manipulated the priming of cells. We did a variety of different tests on them. Some of them involved giving a drug. Some involved changing something in the cell's environment so as to alter the priming of the cell as measured by BH3 profiling. And in each case, we found that the chemosensitivity of that cell altered in exactly the way that we predicted it would.
And I gather that, you know, in looking at this variable, this mitochondrial priming, it sheds some light not only on sort of which cancers are most responsive to chemotherapy, but on the question you sort of touched on at the beginning, why chemotherapy targets cancer cells in particular and not normal cells at all.
Yeah, I really think it does, because when we studied normal tissues, these might include, you know, heart muscle, skeletal muscle, brain, kidney, liver. When we study these normal tissues, these are tissues that in general don't sort of just melt away when you give them chemotherapy. They're quite resistant to chemotherapy. We found that they were quite unprimed, quite far from the cliff's edge. And probably what's most interesting is the one exception, the normal cells that we consistently found most primed, whether we looked at normal human tissues or normal mouse tissues, were the blood cells and the bone marrow cells. And I don't think it's just a coincidence that those are consistently found to be the most chemosensitive cells in both mice and humans.
Well, as you mentioned in your paper, chemotherapy has now been in use for something like six decades or more without our completely understanding why it works. Beyond casting light on that, where do you see all of this leading? Are there any sort of clinical implications in what you've shown?
I think there's two direct clinical implications of what we've done. One of them is I think we're certainly going to be testing this now, whether or not BH3 profiling can be used as a predictive biomarker in the clinic. That is to say, can it be used as a tool for oncologists to test a tumor sample and say, oh, well, it looks like the patient is not going to respond to this type of therapy that kills via apoptosis. We're going to have to select a different type of therapy. That way, to direct patients toward therapies that work and also prevent them from getting therapies that are toxic and futile. The other thing that I think is it also conceptually makes the point that there could be benefit to be obtained from therapeutics that don't by themselves kill a cell, but are able to prime it. What if you had a therapeutic that wasn't able to kill a cancer cell, but it could cause enough death signaling to move it from far from the edge to close to the cliff's edge so that, say, conventional chemotherapy could then come in and finish off the job? That would be a way of identifying therapeutics that would be very useful in a combination context, but not so useful as a single agent. This is really what people are talking about when they talk about personalized medicine. This is really potentially a mechanism for personalizing cancer therapy in a way we haven't been able to do in the past.
Anthony Letai, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You can read the paper by Anthony Letai and colleagues at www.scienceexpress.org.
A Burmese python can go a full year without food, and once it does score a meal, its heart nearly doubles in size while it digests. Humans also experience short-term cardiac growth, but under both healthy and harmful circumstances, and a damaged heart may not properly expand when it needs to. A team led by Leslie Leinwand of the University of Colorado, Boulder, investigated the mechanisms that underlie pythons' dramatic cardiac growth with the goal of eventually developing drugs to boost the heart's performance or prevent the more dangerous forms of heart growth. Leinwand spoke with me about the findings from her office in Boulder.
So it has been known for some time through other scientists' work that Burmese pythons have an amazing response to a cycle that is normal for them of fasting and feeding. So a python in the wild can exist for months at a time without eating anything and nothing terrible happens to it. When it does eat, then it eats a huge meal that can be equivalent to half of its body mass or even more. And the python has evolved a way of dealing with that huge meal that includes a near doubling of the sizes of many of its organs, except for the brain. And the organ that we were the most interested in is the heart. And so the hearts of pythons grow enormously in a very short period of time, and then the tissue gets broken down in an equally short period of time. We set out to understand how the python does that with the hope of being able to transfer that knowledge that we might gain from studying pythons to mammals.
And in particular, you were interested in cardiac growth within humans. This phenomenon does happen in humans. In what contexts do our hearts grow, and what are the common effects?
So the heart grows just as a function of time after birth, and it grows by increasing the sizes of the cardiac cells themselves. So this is a normal process of growth from the time that you're born. Now, the heart in a mammal can get bigger in response to normal physiological cues like postnatal life. It also can get larger in response to pregnancy, let's say, or probably most relevant to this study, in response to chronic exercise. So there's a type of cardiac enlargement that's called athlete's heart, and that is a good type of cardiac growth. And one would, of course, like to promote that kind of healthy cardiac growth. So someone who is a swimmer or a cyclist could have a very large heart, and it's associated with health benefits. It's also been quite well documented that exercise in the setting of heart disease is also quite beneficial. Now, in contrast to that, the heart can get bigger in response to chronic high blood pressure or certain mutations in genes. And those processes are associated with more pathologic events, and those are, you know, not beneficial. So our hypothesis was that the python is exhibiting the beneficial type of cardiac growth because it wouldn't make teleological sense for an animal to evolve a process that it carries out throughout its life that would be pathological or bad for it. And so we wanted to find out whether that type of growth that the python exhibits is the beneficial type. Now, it is true that our hearts, yours or mine or that of a laboratory mouse, can get bigger, but it never is so dramatic and so rapid as what's seen in the python. So we wanted to get to the bottom of how the python undergoes this type of cardiac growth and whether we might be able to transfer that information to a mammalian system.
So how did you go about answering that question, and what did you find?
So what we found was that, in fact, our hypothesis seemed to be true, correct, that the python was activating all kinds of beneficial, what we would call signaling pathways, more or less like a traffic light, that would signal the heart to get bigger in a beneficial way. Studying the python turned out to be fairly challenging, though, because there was not the same amount of information about its genome and how the genes function as there might be in a more traditional laboratory animal. So it, again, was known from the work of Stephen Secor and Jared Diamond that the triglycerides, or the fats in the blood of the snakes after they eat, were extremely high. In fact, if you look at the serum or the plasma, it's milky. And so our idea was that since most of the organs in the python were getting bigger, that whatever is signaling the organs to get bigger would likely be in the blood. And because the fats were so high, we set about using some traditional, more biochemical approaches to identify what that compound might be. And it led us to the notion of these fatty acids or lipids in the blood. My postdoc, who was the first author on this paper, did an experiment that was really a leap. She asked the question, well, since the blood probably has something that makes the python organs get bigger, if we actually take the fractionated blood and put it onto mammalian cardiac cells, will it make them grow as well? And that was a kind of eureka moment, because it turned out it worked. And that then led us into many new directions, because being able to transfer this to mammals certainly made it possible to conceptualize that it might lead to some sort of therapeutic treatment down the road.
So what were the specific compounds that you found in the blood that were responsible for this?
So they are three fatty acids that are present in python blood after they eat. And they are ones that aren't normally found at these exact proportions in mammalian bloodstream. And so what we found was that you needed that particular combination to evoke that growth. To identify that it was those three, we did two experiments that were fairly critical. One was to introduce those into the python itself, so into a fasted python. And we saw that the heart growth was recapitulated not by eating a big meal, but by ingesting these fatty acids. And so the next step, of course, was to ask whether we could do exactly the same thing in a mouse. And we found that the same thing happened. We infused healthy mice with these fatty acids, and we got a significant growth in cardiac mass. And we were able to determine that that was not the type of cardiac growth that we see, let's say, with high blood pressure, but seemed more akin to the type of growth that we call beneficial or physiologic.
So fatty acids in great quantities, aren't those supposed to be harmful for our heart?
Yes, and it depends on which fatty acids. And you are correct that people with very high triglycerides are treated for that consequence. And so people will take medications to decrease the triglycerides in their blood. The thing that made this a little bit more interesting is the fact that the pythons appeared not to have any negative consequences of having these very high levels of triglycerides in their blood. And so we wanted to understand how they were protected from what we would call lipotoxicity. And we have uncovered some of the mechanisms whereby the python is protected. Furthermore, and probably more importantly, we don't see any pathological consequences when we introduce those same three fatty acids into a mouse.
So this seems like a really interesting find. What are the next steps?
So what we next plan to do, and actually are currently doing, is to ask whether or not administering these fatty acids to an animal model of heart disease is effective in either preventing or reversing some of the negative consequences of a disease setting. We believe that this would be the next hurdle to overcome in terms of thinking about applying this as a therapeutic into humans.
Well, Leslie Leinwand, thank you so much for speaking with me.
And thank you.
Leslie Leinwand and colleagues report fatty acid-driven cardiac growth in this week's Science.
Nuclear fusion power. We've read about it in comic books and science fiction novels for the better part of a century, and yet scientists have been unable to induce a reaction in which more energy is produced than consumed. Some scientists at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory's National Ignition Facility, however, think that commercial-scale nuclear fusion might be achievable in just a bit more than a decade, using a dark horse technique called inertial confinement fusion. Science's Daniel Cleary spoke with me about the facility and its unusual approach to fusion, which he profiles in a pair of News Focus articles this week.
A fusion is a nuclear reaction. You know, it's where you bang together nuclei so hard that they actually meld together and make a larger nucleus. And this is the process that powers the sun and stars. That's why stars shine. But getting the process to work on Earth is much harder, and researchers have been working on it for more than half a decade. One particular sort of fusion, called inertial confinement fusion, is about to have a big step where this big facility in California hopefully will prove that it's possible. And so the government is trying to find out, should they start a program to really make an effort to get this to work as an energy source and make fusion power stations?
Well, let's step back. The facility at which this is all happening is the so-called National Ignition Facility. And the story, as you say, deals with this quest for fusion through this technique called inertial containment fusion, or ICF. Could you just talk a little bit more about what exactly ICF is?
Yes. It's a way of doing fusion where you take a very small little capsule of fuel, which may be only a millimeter across, and you have to get it extremely hot. You know, fusion won't happen until you get to a temperature of about 100 million degrees. So you use a driver, they're called. In the case of the National Ignition Facility, it's an extremely energetic laser. And you crush that capsule down to a tiny size to get its temperature up to that level. And once you get it there, then the fusion starts to take place. It's called inertial confinement because the capsule fuel is imploding. So the inertia inwards is what holds it together when the fusion starts happening.
And this isn't the only, you know, approach to fusion, obviously. At one point in your story, you refer to ICF as a sort of a poor relation to other approaches to fusion.
Yes, there's two main approaches. Apart from inertial confinement, there's also magnetic confinement fusion. And in that case, instead of taking a little capsule of fuel, you have a large volume of gas, of hydrogen gas, and you hold it in place as you heat it up with very strong magnets. So it's the magnetic field that contains it. And you heat it and heat it to up to similar sort of temperatures, and then the reactions start to happen. So it's more of a steady state phenomenon, whereas inertial confinement fusion is an explosion, a small explosion.
Well, right now, the National Ignition Facility, which is working on inertial confinement fusion, and I think it's a project of Lawrence Berkeley Lab, is that right?
Lawrence Livermore Lab.
Or Lawrence Livermore, I'm sorry. And so right now, the NIF is in this quest basically to get an ignition, essentially, to make this happen once. How is that actually going?
Well, not fast enough for some people. Some people are saying that they're too ambitious and it'll never work. But, you know, others, I'd say the majority of people in the field think they're getting there, but it's taking a little while. You know, they've been working at it a couple of years since the facility was finished. And they're working through, it's a very complicated process because you have to get this implosion to happen in exactly the right way with the right speed and the right shape to get it down to this tiny size so that you achieve the high temperatures. So they're working through the parameters and keeping everything under control. and they're confident that they will get there, but they're reluctant to say exactly when.
Well, these experiments sound very, you know, technically challenging and interesting, but as I read your story, one thing that occurred to me, and indeed that you bring out in the story, is that even if these experiments result in an ignition, it's still quite a long way to get from that to something that would actually produce power in any meaningful sense. What is NIF looking ahead to in that area?
Well, they've got very ambitious plans about what they want to do next if the government is prepared to fund it for them. An ignition is a demonstration that in this reaction they can produce more energy out than they put in to make it happen, because it takes a lot of energy to heat up the fuel to that temperature. But you need the reaction to produce more. But with an inertial fusion power station, one explosion doesn't produce a lot of energy, so you have to have a lot of them. And one of the biggest challenges for turning it into an energy source is being able to do this at a high repetition rate. The people at NIF, their plans for the future talk about a power station that's going to do it 10 times a second or more. And that's a big challenge, because you have to have a laser that can fire these very high energy pulses 10 times a second. You know, such a laser doesn't exist at the moment. You know, you have to be able to clear away your debris very fast before the next explosion happens. And you have to make the targets, which are quite precision bits of engineering. And if you're shooting 10 times a second, that's nearly a million targets every day.
Well, that does sound a bit difficult. I think that there is a specific project, though, they've even proposed. I seem to remember it's called LIFE or something like that. Could you talk a little bit about the specifics of that plan?
Yes. Well, they're taking a very pragmatic approach, and they're saying, on the assumption that in the next year or two they get ignition to work, you know, what would be the quickest way to make a power station using the technology of NIF as their starting point? So changing it as little as possible, taking technology that exists today, how fast could they turn that into a power station? And they are predicting that they could do it in 12 years. Some people say that's extremely ambitious, but that's their plan. And they've spoken to utility companies to see whether they would be interested in such a reactor, which they are. And they've spoken to suppliers about whether they could supply the equipment, the lasers, the other materials that they would need, and at what sort of cost. The lasers they would need are too expensive today, but, you know, semiconductor manufacturer prices go down all the time. So they're predicting that in 5 or 10 years' time, the lasers will be affordable.
So there's a lot of contingencies here in their grand design, but I guess it ultimately boils down to first getting an ignition at all.
Absolutely. You know, that is going to be the starting point for this whole process. If they can demonstrate that they can get ignition and it's repeatable, and then they can, you know, refine it to get a bigger yield, so more energy out of each pulse, then that'll really give a lot of impetus to researchers that are working in this area. And they're hoping the government is going to see this potential and fund a concerted program to develop a fusion power station using this method.
So the NIF people have suggested the possibility of a power plant in as little as 12 years. What are the people elsewhere in the community, or even, you know, sort of at NIF and elsewhere in the community, saying about where all this is going?
Well, others working in the field are equally enthusiastic. You know, they're waiting for NIF as much as the people at Livermore are, because it'll just boost the whole field. But not everyone agrees on the best way forward. Some people think that NIF is a great research machine, and that if it can produce fusion, it'll be a great demonstration. But it's not the way to produce a power reactor. They have designs for other types of laser, which would be more easy to turn into a high repetition rate machine. Other places suggest other sorts of driver. So you could have ion beams instead of lasers. You could use magnetic pulses to crush the fuel capsule. So there are quite a lot of proposals on the table. And the National Academy of Sciences is in the process of assessing all of these to try and make a plan of how to move forward once ignition is achieved.
Dan Cleary, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
Daniel Cleary writes about the National Ignition Facility's Inertial Confinement Fusion Program in two News Focus articles this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first, David, we got a story that may help explain why some sounds can just be downright painful.
Right. Well, Carrie, this story is actually painful to read, not because it's poorly written, but because of what it's about. And it's about fingernails scratching on a chalkboard, and just saying that sort of sends some chills up my spine. But basically, the question in this study is, why is that particular sound so annoying to us? And it's not annoying to everybody, but I think it's a fair bet that it's annoying to most of us. And so researchers actually investigated this. They said, you know, what is it about this sound? What's going on physiologically that makes us have such an adverse reaction to it?
So it sounds like a really fun question to answer. How did they set this up?
Well, fun, I guess, if you like listening to nails on a chalkboard. But so basically what they did was they recruited some subjects and they sort of optimized this sound. They played them a variety of sounds, and they tried to see which sound of fingernails sort of raking against a chalkboard they had the most negative reaction to. And they sort of isolated this sound. And then they sort of played around with the audio file. They tweaked some of the frequency ranges, and they modified the recording in other ways. And then they played it back to another group of volunteers. And some of the volunteers, they told them, you're about to hear fingernails on a chalkboard. And to some of the volunteers, they said, you're just going to hear a contemporary musical composition.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing the researchers noticed is that when people were told they were going to hear fingernails on a chalkboard, they had a much more adverse reaction to that. And the way the researchers measured this was not only the people's reporting of, hey, I didn't like that sound, but also the researchers monitored the subject's heart rate, their blood pressure, and the electrical conductivity of their skin. And this is a very classic way to test stress. The changes in the conductivity of the skin can actually be an indicator of how stressed out you are. So when the researchers played this sound, even the people that thought they were listening to classical music and said, well, it's not so bad, we're showing a lot of these changes in electrical conductivity, suggesting that physiologically our bodies just have a really sort of negative reaction to the sound, regardless of whether we know what the sound is coming from.
And that could explain why Igor Stravinsky was rioted when he premiered his Rite of Spring.
Could be.
So when the sound was manipulated, how did that affect these listeners' perceptions?
Well, that was the other interesting thing. The researchers found that if they removed frequencies in the sound in the range of 2,000 to 4,000 hertz, it made the sound a lot easier to listen to. And the interesting thing is that sounds in this frequency range are actually in the same frequency range as human speech. So you wouldn't expect that to be the annoying part of the sound, but that's what the researchers found. And in fact, if the researchers took that out and left the noisy scraping parts of the sound in, the listeners didn't say the sound was any more unpleasant. So there seems to be a few different things going on here with the audio. The other thing is that the researchers found that was really interesting is that the shape of our ear canals could actually be part of the reason these sounds sound so bad to us. The researchers found that the ear canal seems to amplify sounds in this 2,000 to 4,000 hertz frequency range, and therefore it makes these sounds even more painful and abrasive than they would be otherwise. So there's actually an interplay of a lot of things going on here for why we find fingernails on a chalkboard such an annoying sound.
And in our next story, physicists and engineers are beginning to see the light.
Right. Well, Carrie, from the last story, which dealt with frequencies of sound, now we're dealing with wavelengths of light. And as you implied, physicists are seeing the light because they're using light to actually move objects around.
And so this all falls within the field of optomechanics. Can you explain what that means exactly?
Right. Well, basically, optomechanics is sort of like what it sounds like. It's using light to move things around. And that seems like kind of like an unusual concept because we don't think of light as really exerting any force or having any sort of mass that would enable it to push anything around. But in fact, in the field of optomechanics over the past few years, researchers have been able to do this. They've used light to influence the motion of a number of tiny physical objects. And in this new study, they take it to a whole new level. They've used light to actually bend a bridge. Now, when I say bridge, I don't mean anything that you could drive over. This is an extremely tiny bridge. In fact, it's 10 micrometers long, 500 nanometers wide and 110 nanometers thick. Not something that you would even probably notice, but you can see a picture of it on the site. And the setup here is they created this silicon bridge, and this bridge was not suspended over water. It was suspended over a glass chip. And then what the researchers did was they pumped laser light into the bridge at various wavelengths. And what they found is, depending on the wavelength, they could either cause this bridge to bow up or bow down. Think about holding a deck of cards in your hand and squeezing your hand. The cards will either bow up or bow down. And that's exactly what the researchers saw here with this tiny, tiny bridge.
So in essence, they were creating sort of a binary switch.
Exactly.
Up
and
or down.
Exactly. And that's what's kind of cool about this, because researchers have been talking for a while about another field, which is known as optical computing. And the idea is that today's computers are all electron-based. But researchers would like to move into optical computers, which would mean that light was basically flipping all the little tiny quote-unquote switches in your computer, going from 1 to 0, which is the whole binary code that all computers deal with. And the idea would be here that they've actually found a way to do that. They found a way to use light to be able to physically flip something from one configuration into another.
And lastly, Dave, what's the deal with laundry lint?
Well, Carrie, when we think of laundry lint, or at least when I think of laundry lint, I usually think about dryer lint, cleaning out that sort of crud that accumulates in the lint bin of the dryer. But this is about lint that actually accumulates in the washer. This is lint that we never see. And what I'm talking about here is these tiny fibers of polyester that come out of our clothing, and they get washed away as the water leaves the washing machine and get dumped out into the ocean. Now, for a while, researchers have been wondering, A, whether this even happens, and B, what impact that might be having on marine life. And that's what this new study is all about.
So these fibers would be extremely tiny. How on earth can we figure out their impact on something so large as the ocean?
Well, it's a great question, and it took a lot of work. What these researchers basically did was they flew to beaches on 6 continents, and they scooped sand from 18 beaches in total. Then back in the lab, they painstakingly separated the plastic from the sand, a process that literally involved hand plucking these little microscopic fibers out of the sand. Doesn't sound like a lot of fun, and it took them a long time to do it. But when they did it and they took these fibers out, they did a chemical analysis on the fibers, and the analysis showed that nearly 80% of these fibers were made of polyester or acrylic, which are compounds that are commonly found in the textiles that we wear. Not a single beach that these researchers looked at was free of this washer lint. And each cup of sand that they scooped up contained at least 2 of these fibers and as many as 31.
So how are these fibers getting there?
Well, what the researchers think is happening is, and they also tested this by looking at wastewater and ocean sediments, and basically what they were able to do is to essentially trace the fibers back to washing machines. And to confirm this, they actually went out and bought a bunch of polyester blankets, fleeces, and shirts, and commandeered the washing machines of 3 volunteers and actually washed these garments for several months. They collected the wastewater from the washing machines and filtered it. And lo and behold, they were recovering the same types of microfibers that they were seeing on these beaches all around the world. So they're pretty confident that this stuff is actually coming from our washing machines and not some other source.
And so it gets from the washing machine to the beaches through the sewer systems.
Exactly. And so the next question is, what impact is it having on marine life? And that's actually a question the researchers weren't able to answer in the study. What they do know is that these fibers can absorb pollutants like DDT. They can also end up in fish and other marine organisms, which means that they go from the washing machine to the ocean back to our dinner plate. But the big question remains, are they really dangerous? And that's going to have to be the topic for future research. Now we know that they're getting out there. The question is, are they having an impact on marine life or even us?
Okay, and what other news stories have we had in the last week?
Well, Carrie, on Science Now, we've got a story on dinosaur migration, also a story about the oldest case of prostate cancer in ancient Egypt. This comes from some pretty detailed analysis of an Egyptian mummy. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about an XPRIZE being offered for the first group to sequence a human genome for $1,000. Also, a story about the public's thoughts on geoengineering. This is an emerging science which seeks to reverse the effects of climate change with man-made solutions. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the intersection of art, humor, and science, how scientists can best express their creative side, and whether there's room for art and humor in scientific research. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
And this is hot on the heels of the Dance Your PhD contest.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, thanks, Dave. David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news on the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the October 28th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.